So hi everyone, it's Chris Simpson from the Stage Left podcast. I hope you're hanging in there at the moment and doing okay as we record this in early January 2021. Huge episode coming up with Gail Ann Dorsey, David Bowie's bassist. And why is it a huge episode? Well, as many listeners know, Tony Visconti appeared days before David Bowie passed away and discussed about how they were recording Black Star using mic positions and talking about how Ashes to Ashes achieved this incredible guitar sound by using the staircase of the recording studio. Loads of great stuff. That was 5 years ago now, would you believe? And we've had lots of requests to do more Bowie-related episodes in that time. But personally, I didn't want to revisit the Bowie world until it felt right, and now feels right with Gail Ann Dorsey, who you'll be hearing from in a moment. We do this away from three other jobs. So if you do want to buy us a coffee or buy us a beer that we can enjoy whilst we're sitting here in the middle of the night editing our episodes, you can do that on our website. So it's thestageleftpodcast.com. Also, you can help us by just subscribing. Hit subscribe so you'll get a notification every time a new episode comes up. Or just joining the conversation on Facebook, Twitter or Instagram. So if you just search on either of those platforms or any of those platforms for at the Stage Left Pod or at the Stage Left Podcast, you'll find us. And on Instagram, we have kind of behind the scene photos of interviews we do, etc., etc. We've got upcoming episodes with members of Gorillaz and also with DMAs as well as a load of other cool stuff we've got up our sleeve, which we'll be sharing in due course. We hope you enjoy it. It's a special one. This is Gail Ann Dorsey.
This is Gail Ann Dorsey.
Okay, welcome to the Stage Left podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. This podcast exists to provide free educational content for young musicians entering an increasingly complex industry by telling the stories of some of the unsung heroes behind the success. So go to thestageleftpodcast.com for all episodes featuring members of Radiohead, Queen, Earth, Wind & Fire, Guns N' Roses, Fleetwood Mac, The 1975, Madness, Oasis, The Zootons, The Prodigy and Kraftwerk, where they discuss their writing, performing and recording processes, as well as reflective interviews with musicians and producers who've worked in the studio and on stage with the Beatles, Beyonce and Elvis Presley. Today we are joined by Stage Left Royalty, with an individual who has spent her career standing shoulder to shoulder with greatness, firstly as member of Charlie Watts' big band, before being David Bowie's bassist both live and in the studio for 20 years, singing joint lead vocal on Under Pressure, and playing hundreds of concerts globally. And on top of this, our guest today has played regularly with the likes of Lenny Kravitz and Gwen Stefani, and recently performed the most spine tingling standalone vocal on the opening track of the new record by The National. It is Gail Ann Dorsey. Today we'll be charting the developmental process Gail went through, from crying herself to sleep each night at the fear of being asked to play something she couldn't play by Bowie, to putting in such iconic performances that even Brian May from Queen asked her to join after seeing how Gail emulated Freddie Mercury. More of that later. We record this 5 years ago to the day we released our episode with Tony Visconti, so it's time now for some more Bowie-based love. So it's a pleasure to say that our guest today on the Stage Left podcast is none other than Gail Ann Dorsey. Thanks for joining us today, Gail. How's it going?
Great, Chris. Happy to be here. Thank you for inviting
me. Absolute pleasure. Now, I'm recording this in London, in Lambeth, and actually, I don't know if you know, probably do, that there's a line in Please Mr. Gravedigger on Bowie's first album where he talks about going and finding little churchyards in Lambeth. Where is home for you? Where are you right now?
Home for me? Well, actually, it's New York. I'm in Kingston, New York, not New York City. I've lived It's about 90 miles north of New York City. They call it the Hudson Valley area, the Catskills. I've been living here, about 25 years now, longer than I've lived anywhere, any one place in my whole life. And before that, I was living in London, and I was in the borough of Lambeth. I was living in Clapham North and Brixton.
So really? That's walking distance?
Yeah, I lived 11 years in London in the 80s.
Yeah, I've read about that, and we're going to come to that in a moment. I wonder, in regards to the feeling of home, is it a bit different, do you think, for a session musician or any musician traveling the world to actually find, you know, if I was to ask you to describe what the word home conjures up to you, is it where you are now, or is home being on tour, or is it where you grew up?
It's all of those things. That's a good question. It's kind of all of those things. But I feel like mostly home for me has been moving, is being on tour. Believe it or not, hotels are more like home than home sometimes, you know. But I think recently home has been a little bit more appeal, like my actual physical place where I live has been a bit more feeling like home, like, I guess, you know, more appealing to return home and kind of be with my things and kind of, you know, cook, make my own food. Those are the nice things about being home.
You know, I know your mother grew up in Virginia in 1921. Yes. I wonder if she ever kind of described what it was like for someone, you know, female of colour in 1921 in Virginia, what her life was like and how it went on, you know, that you then became such a successful musician. Did she understand the scale of what you achieved?
She did in the end. You know, I think that I was always I was the youngest of five kids, and I was different because I was, from the beginning of my memory, I was always infatuated with music. I just knew that that was something that was the most important thing in my life. So, you know, most kids want to go out and play and do things, but I wanted to just be home practicing or writing or doing, you know, kind of creative things. So I was a little bit of a kind of isolated kid, like self-isolated, you know, bit of a hermit. My mother never talked a lot about her experience, and I think it was extremely traumatic, I can only imagine, because even my youth in the 70s, growing up in Philadelphia, like racially, it was horrible. I had so many terrible experiences with racism and you know, just kind of feeling afraid and threatened and all of those things. So I can only imagine what she had lived through, but she never wanted to talk about it very much. And I think she didn't understand my obsession with music and how, she certainly didn't understand how I thought I was going to make a living doing it. Like, how are you going to, you know, drop out of school and go and play music and you know, make a living? But once, you know, my mother was interesting because even though those were the words that came from her mouth, she actually supported me 100%. So it was interesting. It's kind of like, I think she was having a little bit of a, you know, devil angel on her own, you know, on her own shoulders, going like, well, you know, is this possible for my young, a young little black girl from West Philly to dream so big, to, you know, go and be on stage or make movies or whatever? But at the same time, I think she could see that there was a determination and there was a focus that I had that never faltered. So she continued to support me. She would come to all of my little, you know, little shitty gigs or what, it didn't matter, from the smallest thing to, like, you know, ending up seeing me with Bowie and being there and, you know, in the dressing room with us even. So she, you know, I think she knew instinctively, intuitively, I don't know what you would call it, I think she had a lot of faith in me, but her practical mind was always saying, you should think of, you know, do something, you know, make sure you get a better job, or why didn't you finish school, or, you know, all those things. So, but it worked out. It worked out fine.
So she was born 100 years ago now, is that right?
1921, yeah. She was born in 21. Yeah. Oh, my goodness, yeah. That's right. Yeah.
So the world's come a long way in 100 years, but not nowhere near as far as it should have done. But
yeah, I never even thought about that now, because she passed away in 2011. So she's been gone, on would be 10 years this year. I can't even believe it. Wow. And she was just shy of her 90th.
Is it right that you learned to play the guitar out of tune? Because I think your godmother found a guitar, gave it to you, but you didn't know what to do with the tuning pegs. And so is it right that you had to learn the intervals and play? Would you have been playing chords out of tune?
I don't think I was playing chords at that point. I think I was just plunking out whatever I could find, you know, on the little one of those acoustic guitars where that just murder your fingers. I don't even know how I managed to to do that, because I'm a baby now. I'm like, oh, I want, if the action isn't really low, I don't want to touch it. I was afraid. I didn't want to break it. I didn't want to break the strings. I didn't know how to change the strings if I broke one. I didn't know if the little tuning heads would snap. I was just terrified. But I just, however it showed up, I managed to probably work with two or three strings at a time to try and figure out how to play little riffs and things. I remember trying to learn Rufus and Chaka Khan songs, like You've Got the Love, the little riff, you know, little things like that. I could sort of find these things on the guitar, but I didn't play chords until I kind of got a better guitar and met some other musicians who said, hey, your guitar's out of tune, let me do that. I remember someone taking the guitar and tuning it, and I freaked out because I was like, shit, I gotta start all over again. But yeah, I did. I had it out of tune. I don't even remember for how long, but I was 9 years old when I got it. So,
and one of the first songs I think you learned to sing was Sitting on the Dock of the Bay, which I don't know if you know this, but I don't know if you know the story, and actually, it's very lucky, Steve Cropper came on here a couple of years ago and he told this story that the reason why there's no minor chords in that song, which is kind of surprising for such a melancholic song, but the reason that was kind of similar to what you were saying, is that Otis couldn't play any minor chords on guitar, so he tuned everything to a major chord and just slid his finger as a bar chord up and down, which is why there's no minor chords in that song, but which you would kind of think there would be.
I never even thought about that. That's incredible.
It's there's some interesting stuff in there. Right, so this episode is, all episodes of Stage Left Podcast, we want to pass on advice to young musicians. But firstly, before I ask you to do that, is what is the best advice you've been given?
believe in myself. My older brothers were always like, I think I always had a lot of, I think because I didn't learn music in a traditional way. We had music in school when I was a kid, so I learned something. I played the clarinet and I could read a little bit on the clarinet, but I never learned theory and things like that. So I always had this, even though I was kind of determined and you know, I guess brave in a way, because I would take on any task, you know, and try anything if the opportunity came, which I still do in a way. But I always felt this little thing inside of me going, well, you don't really know, you're not a real musician. You don't know scales and you don't know chord progressions. You don't know theory. You don't know, you know, a 2-5-1 or whatever that means, you know, all these things. I still don't know some of those things. But I always had, there was always this little needle of doubt. And I think the best advice that my brothers and other people would give me and still give me is believe in yourself. And I have to keep reminding myself that I'm capable of things that I often think I'm not.
What's your technique To get out of something or to say, oh, I can't do that and feel comfortable with it. So a lot of the work that I do away from doing this podcast is I support a lot of people who have performance anxiety or any kind of apprehension about performing in some kind of way. And often I've identified that in 99.9% of cases, it's the fear of a gap in their knowledge being exposed. And so they'll just try and kind of bury their heads in the sand or just try and hope that they never asked about it. It's actually feel quite honest about things and just say, you know, if we can own the phrase, I don't know how to do that, or I'm not 100% sure, or we've got things in our toolkit to actually go, okay, this is how, what's your technique? You know, if Bowie had asked you to, you know, play a certain thing that you didn't know how to do, what is your process at that stage?
Well, internally, I would just freak out. I wouldn't let it show. But I would definitely, have a little bit of a pain in the gut. You know, I have like my anxiety goes straight to my stomach. I'm like, oh dear, you know, I don't feel so good. But I would just go away and work on it, you know. But I usually wouldn't let on. I mean, unless it was something really, you know, someone. Like I can do it now because I have an actual bass with the lines on it, like fretless bass. I've never really played fretless bass, but I have one, a beautiful one that Michael Tobias, MTD bassist, made for me, and he lives in Kingston as well. He's like 10 minutes away, so I can go to the workshop, and we actually built this bass together, and so we kept the fret lines are on the board so I can play it. But sometimes before that, people would say, I'd like you to play fretless on something. And I'd just be like, no, I cannot do that. But for example, like on Sophie B. Hawkins, I did her first tour, her very first tour. And that her big hit, Damn Wish I Was Your Lover, it's a fretless bass, which, you know, kind of slides between the octaves. Doom, doom, like that's the main part of the song. So I had to learn, you know, with pedals and different things, I was able to recreate that sound. And even for Bowie, there was a lot of things that on the first tour I did with him that had fretless bass. Motel, we used to do My Death, some of those sort of kind of ethereal songs. So I managed to replicate that sound, but you know, I would just have to flat out say no to people. You know, I personally, I don't really like the fretless bass. It's not a sound that I like very much. There's a handful of players that I think do it beautifully, but otherwise it's a very strange sound. I'd rather hear the upright, you know, if you're gonna go there, get out the big guns.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think what we want to do with this podcast is just to kind of normalize actually being okay with things that we can't, you know, we're not 100% amazing at. So there's a great clip of B.B. King. He's on stage with U2. He's a guest and he has this kind of half panic to The Edge and says, he says to The Edge, I don't do chords. I don't do chords. I play all the lead stuff. I'm great, but can you take care of the chords? And you see this panic that he might have to be exposed, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's just good to hear that there are areas of development for all of us, you know, and that's fine.
Any fast things too, like a lot of players, I'm not like a speed player, like I don't have a lot of notes in my repertoire, you know, and in some ways I think that's been to my advantage. But I've been to a few like bass clinics once in a while that I've been a part of, like as a panelist or just to speak about my bass experience. And to see some of the other players who can just really, you know, go to town. You know, even my neighbor who actually used to live across the street from me, Tony Levin, you know, he's incredible. He can play all these amazing things, fretless and all that. He's one of my favorites on the fretless as well. He's one of the handful. But I've never been able to do all of that kind of stuff. And I get, like, nervous if there's a job comes to me and it's really full of, you know, more fusion-y or something. It's not really my thing, but I will try it. I'll give it a try, but it's not, it's not where I'm comfortable.
But all those people who, you know, you've just mentioned there, they can't sing. I'm sure they can't sing anywhere near as beautifully as you can. Right. So it's like, they're looking at you and they're thinking, oh, I wish I could sing like that. So it's just it's like a trade off, isn't it? Out of interest, what do you think maybe David Bowie's gap in his knowledge might have been? Or was there anything that you felt that he felt slightly imposter syndrome about?
Maybe. But, you know, I think that he I think he was always capable of finding a way to do whatever it is he had in his creative mind. Like, he would figure it out. And if he couldn't do it, I think his one of his biggest talents, and it's something that I try and think about when I'm working with other people or putting together a project for myself, is that he knew how to get exactly the right people to do it if he couldn't. And also, and he was, you know, at the time I worked with him, I don't know when, in his early days, I see him a lot with the guitar, the 12 string and all that. And he would write things on the guitar or play guitar sometime or bring a guitar in or have a keyboard where he plunked out some ideas. But he wasn't, at the time I worked with him, it wasn't like he was like really proficient on the guitar. Like, he wasn't like comfortable. In fact, he would, if he did pick it up, you know, in 5 minutes, he'd be like, oh, my bloody fingers are killing me. He would just be like, yeah. So, but I think he just felt comfortable with everything. There wasn't anything he couldn't do that came from his own mind. I don't think many people asked him to do things that he wasn't able to do. But for himself, you know, like creating his own things, I think he was capable of so much. And he was a self-taught. He told me a story once about writing songs when he was 16 or something. He said, I used to sit at the kitchen table and he'd have a book and a dictionary and, you know, learning certain words and like just studying like a methodical way of how songs were created. And then you look and you listen to like the very early albums, like this is David Bowie or David Jones or whatever, like his really early records when he was a teenager, pretty much. That stuff is so sophisticated for a 16 or 17 year old. And so, you know, he said he just sat down and he studied how songs were structured, like the French chanson and, you know, how French wrote stuff, you know, which is like Life on Mars is that kind of traditional, the way the chord structure builds on that is like the French chanson, they call it, or whatever, the sort of typical way that French composers have written songs. So he was just always studying, even right to the end. He was always studying something, always reading. And God knows how he remembered it all, but he had a photographic memory. It was unbelievable.
What about like last minute changes from your perspective? So if you're in a situation, you're on stage, like key changes, did that happen a lot? Where it's like, okay, I actually want to go down semitone. What's your tip for a musician in that situation? Because that's a bit scary sometimes.
That's probably what my biggest fear in my whole career was, always that. It still is to some extent, but I've gotten better. Because I've learned to just relax. At first, it would just be the fireworks would just go off inside. Someone would say, oh, no, the key's not right. And especially if it's a really complicated song because I'm learning, everything I learn is from memory. Like, I memorize the patterns and I can kind of sing it in my head. If I can sing it, I can play it. And as soon as, you know, I make up my own little chart, my own way of writing music. So I've got my chart all written out, and then suddenly they drop it two or three keys or whatever, or raise it a key. And I'm like, oh, my God. And I race for my pencil, and I start counting. Okay, if it started on a D, it goes to, and then, you know, and then I'm trying to count all the things and scratch out the old one and write in the new notes quickly, because it's not, if I can see that as a reference. But that's my biggest fear, is key changes when I don't know about theory or what that means, you know, harmony. I just know the mathematics of the fretboard, you know, how, if it's, you know, two steps down, then this is where it is now. But
it's an option in the situation. If someone says, oh, it's just a semitone or a tone, could you, I'm not a bassist, by the way, but like, could you retune just very quickly and just play it as it is? Or would that just not really work?
Not with the bass. I mean, even with a guitar, it's like when you retune, it takes on a whole new character. I used to have, there was one song on the Earthling album, one of my favorite songs, 7 Years in Tibet. Mm. And when I played that bass line on the recording, I played it, the whole bass was tuned down, I think, a whole step. So E was a D and A was a G and et cetera. and set up the bass that way. So it was set that way. It stayed that way. It never changed. So when I would play that song in concert, I had that one bass that was tuned that way, and that's the one I would play because it had a certain vibe to it. And but to just do that on the fly with a guitar, I mean, some guitars can take it. Depends on how well they're made and how, you know, what kind of strings and just how they're set up. But to do that on the fly, just to it would just sound like weird, and then the strings would try and go back the way they were, and as you're constantly tuning, and then they're all flappy, and so you have to kind of think ahead if you're going to detune, especially a bass, because I think it really takes on a different character.
I'm just trying to think of ways we can equip, you know, with ideas that might help young musicians in that situation. Yeah. But I guess it's just knowing your intervals, I guess.
Yeah, it's knowing your intervals, but yeah, it is. It's definitely knowing your intervals. And I guess just practice as well. I mean, because I was forced into situations where I had to change the key, the more it happened, the more I relaxed and realized, okay, it's not like the end of the world. It's not that bad. I might make a few bum notes at first, but then I go, okay, it's just in this key now. It's just kind of shifting your head to just relax, which is not easy to do when you're under a pressure situation, or you're in the studio or something, or you know someone's paying you to play your instrument, and you gotta deliver. You want to deliver. So I think if you just kind of relax a little bit and just know that you can do it. I mean, it's just a key change. It's just different. Just going to be different notes on the instrument, whatever it is, piano, guitar, whatever. So it's, if you think of it that way, it's maybe not as daunting, but it's just a matter
Well, you learnt 80 songs on one of the tours, I think. I think it was the reality tour. You had to learn 80 songs, right? So
yeah, it was.
It shows you it's all in the preparation.
60, 80. We rehearsed a long time too, which was nice. You know, you get a long time to work on that. We would rehearse sometimes for a couple of months or something at least, and on a kind of a really nice work schedule where you just work like a normal job. Get in at 10, go home at 6, you know, just... And then have time in the evening to, you know, go over things, or come in early in the morning and work on your setup or your sound and things like that. But also learning so many songs, because David would want to change the set list most nights. He'd want to add something or just he'd get bored. He didn't like to do the same thing over and over again. So we would rotate the songs in sound check so you don't forget them. Because if you're doing a majority of like 28 songs or 30 a night, there's another 20 that you're not doing or whatever. So you kind of go, oh, let's run through these. You know, the Jerry Leonard, our musical director, would pull up some of the old songs and just so we keep them fresh in our heads. It's a good technique to do.
Yeah, and I guess it keeps it fresh. And actually, in regards to what we're discussing now, I'm really interested in that time, that period between after the sound check on a gig day of, say, a really big performance, and those few hours before going out on stage. How would you advise that best be spent? Because I tell you what a lot of musicians do, they have a few drinks, right? Because you've got that nervous energy and that kind of thing. But this obviously not going to increase your performance necessarily. You know, I think Bowie was sober when you played with him as well. So
yes,
just
was.
Wondering what he and the rest of the band would do in that time that was kind of productive, because there's that kind of nervous or excited energy. What do you do with that, and how do you channel that in that time?
Between soundcheck and the gig? Well, for me, it's like I would do my makeup, which is a kind of, it's not something I like doing. In fact, I hate makeup, but it's part of my job. you know, that would be, I would have some kind of like music, even if it was my iPod or whatever was at the time, whatever device people are using. You know, I put on some soothing music and I get in my dressing room and I do my makeup and try and just kind of relax, burn some incense. I like incense and candles. I'm a big sort of hippie in that way, which is why I live up here in the hippie world of upstate New York. And I might have like a glass of wine before, maybe, but not always. I'm not, you know, a big drinker. I think I started drinking a little more later on, like in my life. Now I'm not drinking at all right now. Actually, I've been off the sauce for quite a while. But I would have like a glass of wine while I'm doing my, you know, kind of just feel like trying to make my space cozy. That's what I would do. I don't know what other people would be in their other space. Some people might be drinking or smoking or whatever, you know. But I would just sort of try and get in my own zone, like make a nice cozy space between that time, because especially with Bowie shows, they were long shows. It was a lot of things to concentrate on, and then, you know, after makeup, it's clothes and the whole thing. So I just like to have that, like, quiet time. Sometimes also do a little yoga. I always had a yoga mat in my wardrobe cases and, you know, do a little stretching before the show.
Now, one show that stands out was the Glastonbury show, I think. It's talked about a lot in the UK. That was a very special. I know you played loads of shows, but, you know, that was a particularly special one. And I always remember in the week run-up to that, that there was kind of a will he or won't he play, because I think he had laryngitis at the time. And we actually interviewed someone who was in the band. He was in a band called Embrace, who were on just before Bowie. And they even got the kind of heads up, say, look, it might be a case that Bowie can't make this and you're going to have to headline. It didn't happen, obviously. And I just wonder if you remember how kind of touch and go that was, or if you remember if that was almost cancelled at all, or if it just went swimmingly.
Well, I do remember that he had learned, all the time I've worked with him, I think he's only ever cancelled. I want to say three shows, if that. And he did have laryngitis. We had two shows in New York City at a place called Roseland. And he had laryngitis before that. So it might have been maybe Glastonbury. I don't remember the time scale, but I think Glastonbury was probably after that. So there was the rumor or whatever. And he did cancel that show, but he went back and made it up. I've done shows with him where he had a flu. I mean, he was sick. There was a bucket on the side of the stage. He was like, you know, in between songs, literally. But he would not cancel a show if he could help it. He never, ever would. I was really impressed. And even times when I was really sick, I got really dehydrated once on the very beginning of touring with him in Las Vegas. And I got really sick, 4 a.m, ambulance came. I was really dehydrated, took me to the hospital, put me on an IV to have fluid. I wasn't drinking enough water or something. And we had a show that night. And I had to get off the IV at 3 o'clock and get to sound check. And I said, no, I'm so tired. I'm just like, he's like, don't worry about it. We can put a chair and you can sit down. I don't care. And I put a chair there and I played the show in the chair and it was really fine. And he didn't care. I mean, some people would just be like, oh, that's just either, I don't know what they would do, either make me, you know, prop me up with a whatever. But he was like, he just didn't want to cancel the show no matter what. And so I was like, you know, I've seen him go through, not feel very well and get up there and give all he's got. No one would ever even know. And so I thought, you know, if he can do that, so can I. And I feel that myself as a performer. I don't want to let anybody down. I love getting on stage and playing. And the people who allow me to do that, I'd do anything for those people.
Was it right you played the show where, did he have a heart attack on stage or he fell ill and then later on it was found out that he had actually had a heart attack and people didn't know, and he didn't know, I think.
He didn't know, He had a shoulder issue. In fact, we were going to finish the reality tour. It was almost over just before he had the heart attack. I think we had 4 weeks or something to go. And he knew that after that he was going to have a surgery on a rotator cuff, like he had an old ski injury, he said, or something from his days in Switzerland. And it was bothering him, so he had to have, you know, they were giving him a cortisone shot or something in the shoulder. So when he had his episode in Prague, it was on stage, he had a pain in his arm, so he thought it was the shoulder. And that's all he concentrated on. And I think he brought everyone else's attention to that. So no one was thinking it was anything else. He was like, I've got this terrible pain in my shoulder. So that's what it was. He didn't know until a day later, almost 2 days later, in Hamburg, they figured it out. We did a show. We tried to finish that show in Prague. And then we got on our plane or bus. I can't remember how we were traveling. And then we went to Hamburg for that, which was going to be a big festival. And there was a day off. So he had time to rest and go to the hospital or the doctors when we got to Germany. And they were like, you have just been in, you know, you've had a heart attack, you know. It took them a little while to figure it out, but they gave him painkillers, so he didn't know. It's crazy, right? He had angels.
Well, it's really...
He just had angels, which is great. They took care of him.
It's really refreshing to hear someone who's so like willing to finish a concert, you know, even though it's against, you know, every instinct really, but, you know, really wanting to, you know, finish concerts and make sure the fans are getting what they want. It's just
Absolutely.
Really refreshing and it's amazing to hear it. Now, a quick question about, so you've got an unbelievable singing voice. So I'm just going to put it out there. So everybody, and there's going to be clips that we're going to show in this. Now, Mick Jagger once said his biggest fear was losing his voice. So do you do anything to look after your voice at all? Or do you, and even with the bass, like, do you do anything to avoid like tendonitis or anything like that?
No, I don't. I'm laughing because I'm like thinking that, because I've made a conscious decision that I better start. I'm not getting any younger. No, I mean, I do. I know what I should do, and sometimes I do it, but it's not a regular routine. And I feel really bad about that. My friend Nathan East, who produced my first solo record in London, actually, you know, he always, you know, he makes me feel bad because he always is like, he practices every day, and he's Nathan East. I mean, he doesn't, you know, everybody needs to practice. I won't say he doesn't need to practice, but he said that when he would go to foreplay, the band he had, the jazz, smooth jazz band or whatever, he would say, if I didn't do some practice and I went to work with the guys, they would know right away, or he could tell. Just in one day, if he hadn't done his little warm-up, or I'm not sure what it is that he does, but he's like, I can tell in one day that I haven't, you know, done that. So that always used to make me feel bad, because I can go weeks and not even look at a bass. But then I'm playing the guitar, or I'm writing on the keyboard, or I'm singing. And so I've kind of split myself between a lot of things, so it's kind of hard to, I guess not got lazy, but I just never worked out a regime to give each one of them enough equal attention of practice. But I am definitely working on that now. I'm doing vocal, I'm planning to do some more, but I did some vocal courses with a guy called Steve Rial, who is the vocal coach for Olivia Newton-John, who is one of my idols. So if he's good enough for her, he's my guy. And he's a beautiful singer as well. He's her backing singer. And then on the bass, I just sort of learn things, you know, sometimes I look at some of the YouTube stuff. I actually have some of Nathan's DVDs where he does these little exercises and things like that. But I've definitely started to do more warm-up things and try and learn. Something I've never been able to do very well on guitar or bass or on a fretted instrument is play backwards, like do a very fast, like say 16th note, do-do-do-do, you know, backwards. That's something you would be able to do if you practice. Like, you know, if you really did your, you know, so I've found these YouTube videos that have given me exercises to do that. And I'm getting better, you know. There's a song, there's a Lenny Kravitz song where I have to do that in a run. It's one of his biggest songs. It's Always on the Run. My mama said, da 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 da. And in the bridge of that, it goes, he plays a, like a double one all the way down the neck, and I could never do it in the 9 years I played with it. So I did my version of it. I would go, you know, something that was close to that, but I just can't, my fingers won't do it. But that would be something that practice would cure, and it's already getting better. I've been doing it on the guitar as well, because I want to do that, but it's like I could never, like, my fingers just, when I want to go there, they just don't, never comes out right.
Changes
I was so, in the research I did for this interview, I was so delighted to hear how passionately you spoke about Olivia Newton-John, about being the person you really admired growing up. Absolutely. And then you went on to work very closely with her, I think, for a long period of time. Here's a question, because they say never meet your heroes. Do you think, sorry, let me rephrase this. Do you think it's a bit of a challenge to compartmentalise that kind of view you have of the person when you're first working with them from actually just doing the job? And actually, the longer you get to know that person and work with them, does that kind of magic slightly dissipate because you see them as a normal person then?
No, it gets bigger, especially if they're a nice person like her. I mean, for me, it was just like, oh, just it's confirmed everything I imagined she was like from just listening to her records and how beautiful her voice is. I just love her voice. To me, you know, I think I told her as well. It's like if you could hear the voice of angels, it would sound like her. Like she'd be one of those voices. It's just so pure and beautiful, and yet she can also rock out and funk out and do soul. I mean, she's very versatile. But her, she's a really, really beautiful human being. Like, and you know, I remember the first day when she walked into rehearsal in Nashville, and I was in this big, like, aircraft hangar kind of place where we were getting ready to rehearse, and she walked in the room, and my heart just... I was like, oh, my God, it's a dream come true. And I just, you know, even the time of the sort of normal time when you just, you know, we actually went to her house in Australia and went to the supermarket and buying groceries, so we're going to go and cook dinner. So it was just like a, you know, I'm walking in the supermarket with Olivia Newton-John getting some lettuce, and you know, it was, and and it's just still that moment, like inside there's always, every now and there's this little bubble and I'm like, that's Olivia Newton-John, I can't believe it. You know, I'm still like a kid, even though, and especially because she's nice, so it just gets bigger. I just feel like, wow, what an experience. I never dreamed. Nathan East played on one of her records in the 80s, in the early 80s, mid 80s. And I remember when he told me that, and I was like, oh my God, you got to play with Olivia Newton-John. And he said, well, maybe one day you will too. And I was like, nah, I'm never going to be good enough. I really thought I could never be good enough to play that kind of material. And even when I was offered the job, I was skeptical, but I was brave. I was like, you know what? I'm going to go for it. If I screw up, I screw up. She gets somebody else. But I know those songs like the back of my hand, so there was no problem. Like, I those bass lines were like almost like burned in my head because I just knew the songs so well.
And did you have to adapt to play a 5-string bass for when you worked with her? Is that right? How easy was that? And is that something that you just took to quite easily, or?
Oh, no, I had to learn that for, like, nearly everybody. In fact, I credit Nathan East for that. When I was doing my first solo album with him, The Corporate World, he came in with his 5-string bass, and I don't think I had one yet. And he said to me, if you're going to continue as a bass player and you want to do sessions and things like that, you better learn the 5-string. And so then I went to Ernie Ball, Stingray, Music Man is my bass of choice, and I got a 5-string, and I started learning. And he was right, because at some period of time, certainly from the 80s all the way through the late 90s, almost every job I had required a 5-string somehow. If I was emulating a keyboard synth or even another bass player or another bass part, everybody was going down to those low D's and low B's. And it wasn't so hard. At first it was like, oh my gosh. But, you know, I remember when Nathan said something about 5-string, in my mind, I'm thinking the strings go up like a guitar. So at first I was like, well, why would you want to have another, what would it be, a B string, I guess? Like, what would be the point of that, you know? Because then you're almost playing a guitar. And he's like, no, it's a low B. It's not a high, you know. So then I was like, oh, okay, yeah. But it was really good. And, you know, funny enough, I haven't played a 5-string for almost 10 years until, like, 2 weeks ago. I just did a video recording here at the Bearsville Theater in Bearsville, New York, for the singer Donna Lewis. She's a British singer. I guess it's 25 years since her big record, Now in a Minute. and she wanted to recreate that record live. So we just recorded the whole album live, videoed on a stage, no audience, of course, at this point. And I guess she's going to release it at some point, or I'm not sure what she's going to do with it, but I was part of the band. And because that material was recorded 25 years ago, almost, I'd say half of it was five string bass. And I had to dust it off, get it out of the old closet. Oh, there it is, the old relic. And so I was playing five string again. It was been a long time. It was a little bit of a stretch, I have to say. I was the old, whatever these are here, were like really
tendons
working
hard. And
yeah, tendons. That's right. I was like, oh my gosh. Especially there's a song where I had to play octaves from the B string to the A string. And it's like, that's quite a stretch. For I don't have very big hands, and my fingers are really skinny, so it takes a lot of work sometimes.
Look after those tendons. Look after those tendons. In years to come, I mean, I know bassists in very big bands who've had to stop doing what they're doing and kind of go under the radar for a while and have surgery and all sorts of stuff.
Yes,
so, you know, it's worth just mentioning it.
No, absolutely.
Now, you talked about Corporate World there, which was your debut album in 88. Mm-hmm. The last album you did, I think, was 2004, which is I Used to Be, I believe. Mm-hmm. I listened to it today. There's so many tunes on there. The last song, that Philadelphia song, it's amazing. Do you think you're going to do more solo stuff, or are you quite happy where you are at the moment playing with other people?
Oh, I'm absolutely going to do solo stuff. I have been planning that for the last few years, and whatever interviews I've done or people I've talked to, I've been saying it, and they're like, oh, you've been telling me that it's been 5 years. I've been very busy, and, you know, I have to say it's hard to, you know, Lenny has kept me busy, and then if there was downtime with him, there was always some project that I was waiting to have a gap so I could do. So I feel really grateful for that, and I just enjoy playing. So I don't have an ego in a sense of like I need to be in front, and it's like I'd want, you know, I just like being part of an ensemble. I want to be with musicians making music. I don't care whether I'm at the microphone or I'm, you know, next to the drums or whatever. I don't really, it doesn't matter to me. Each part is integral to making the music. But now, especially because of the lockdown and I'm not touring and everything at the moment, it's 100% my focus to go and do some solo work now, because I've been wanting to do it. Now I have the time. So I've already started working on some things. I'm definitely going to put out another record this year. I'm excited.
Awesome. And obviously, let's just briefly discuss the work you did with The National. So the opening track on their last album, where you do that isolated vocal about 2 minutes in, which is just so, so good.
I have owed it to my heart, every word I've said. You have no idea how hard I died when you left. If I yield to my trances, will I get up?
Look, I knew about the band. I didn't even really know the music of The National, but I knew there was a band called The National, and I probably had heard a few things, but I didn't really have any of their records and everything, but I knew they were, you know, they were a cool band. And it turned out that Aaron Dessner, one of the twins of The National, the twin brothers, lives not too far from here, about 30 minutes away on the other side of the river in near Hudson. And in 2018, I was part of a local concert for our Democratic, what do you call them, politicians, whatever, our local. It was one of our elections, and we were trying to get all of the people that we wanted voted and so elected. So there was a concert that was put on here in Kingston, where I live, in a very big venue, one of our nicest theaters. And there's a lot of celebrities that live in this area, or musicians, actors, writers. We had Mary Stuart Masterson, Paul Rudd, Eve Ensler, who wrote the Vagina Monologues, Jack DeJohnette, Rachel Yamagata. You know, it was just this amazing lineup of people. And I was one of the artists performing that night. And Aaron Dessner was there that night, and I didn't know he was there until even after the show. So he was introduced to me after the show. He saw me do my songs, and he said, you know, there's another benefit happening in Hudson for Planned Parenthood in a few weeks. would you like to come and open for my band, The National? Like, because he knew that I'd play acoustic guitar and do opening, and I can just, you know, I'm self-contained in a sense. I said, yeah, I'd love to. It's a great cause. So that's when I kind of got to know The National. They were performing for this benefit, and then I opened for them. And then at the end of that night, Aaron came up to me again, and he said, we're making this album at the moment we're doing something different than we normally do. We're having other artists come and sing, other female artists singing with Matt. And we wondered if you would you like to come and do some vocals on this record? Sure, why not? You know, and then, okay. So I go, his studio is here in Hudson as well, where they make all the National records. So I went there. I actually was busy. I remember not being able to schedule, and I had one Sunday free. I said, it's a Sunday, but it's the only day I can make it. I said, great, come on over. So I get there, and there's just, most of the tracks are already recorded. And the music was for a film, which I didn't know, like a short film, a 30-minute film. The director of the film was there as well, and Mike Mills. And so I get there, and all the tracks are already recorded. I just have to add my vocals. So there was most of it was not, some of it I had to make up on my own. I'm trying to remember now. Some of it had a guide vocal. Matt's vocal was there, and I was supposed to either sing the same thing with him or make a harmony to him. Like, it was kind of open. They kind of left it open. And I remember I sang on a lot of songs. I was there all day. I went there at like noon, and I left at like 11 o'clock at night, and I sang on like 10 songs or something like that. And I think I ended up on 6 or 7. Like, they changed. There were different things. They had other people still to come and do parts. So that was just like it just happened that way. And then the record came out, and I was like, oh my God, this sounds incredible. I couldn't, you know, obviously, you know, you come in on a session and it's not mixed and you don't know what else is going to happen. And then you finally hear the mix and the final product. And I'm so proud of that record. It's like one of my, for me as a singer, it was one of my best moments. I was like, wow. I think I know how to do this now. Sometimes I'm not very confident about my singing in some ways, just because I have a particular sounding voice. I can blend very well with most people. But sometimes when I'm on my own, I don't even like the sound of my voice. You know what I mean? Like sometimes. No, not the sound. It's like, I don't know. I can't describe it. I love singing. Don't get me wrong. I love singing, and I'm grateful to have this voice, because I realize it's probably the biggest gift I really have. I think, aside from the bass playing, all the rest, it's my thing. And I think playing instruments was just to supplement that, to be honest. But I just love what I did on that record, and they gave me, Aaron gave me a lot of freedom, actually, and the director, to do things. And when I'd come out of the vocal booth at one point, and the director was tears streaming down his face, so I was like, okay, I must have got it right. Either I got it right or I got it wrong. But they were like, oh, no, that's beautiful. That's exactly what we wanted to hear. So, like on things like Rosie and on the record, which is a beautiful song written by Matt's wife. The lyrics, incredible. So that's kind of how that happened. It was, you know, a lot of what I've done, I think, has been right place at the right time. I've been just in a good spot, and someone sees me, or, you know, and it leads to something else later on. So that's why I feel like, if I have any advice to young players, don't turn down anything. And not unless it's, you know, dangerous, or it's, you know, you don't want to go, if you're a young girl or whatever and you're learning bass and you don't want to go to some strange person's house by yourself, the obvious things. But if there's an opportunity to play, even if it's maybe music you don't even like so much, take it. Because you never know who's going to be there, or who might see you, or who you might meet, or what might come from that situation. And I think a lot of my career has been because of that. Because I've just gone out and done whatever comes up, because I want to play.
So John Lennon said once that he hated his own voice as well. So it's just really interesting that we I don't think anyone likes the sound of their own voice. But honestly, I mean, it's really interesting. You got that emotional response from the producer, and often people cite Under Pressure as being creating a bit of an emotional shift when they listen to that. So, you know, you've got a beautiful voice, but like everybody, we don't like the sound of our own voices. That's kind of normal. What I was going to say is it's funny that you just mentioned that, because my next question was, is there anything you have said no to in the past that you wish you said yes to?
There's been a few things this last year and some of the years with Lenny Kravitz, because even though Lenny wasn't touring all the time, this was the probably the most regular job I'd had as a musician, because we worked all the time. We worked all year. We did corporates, we did private events, we did, you know, other, you know, festivals, we did all kinds of stuff that was constantly keeping me working all year. So people would think, well, you know, I don't tour, but yeah, but I'm working. Next week we were going here, and this week we're in DC, blah, blah, blah. So it was hard for me to fit anything in that was a long period of time. Say somebody had a short tour for 2 months or 3 months, and there were a bunch of things that came in that I just couldn't take, because if I said yes when there was a space on the calendar, you know, I was obligated contractually to go with Lenny. So anyone who would hire me in my little downtime would have to know there's a possibility I'm going to cancel. So if they were okay with that, that's fine, but you can't do that on a tour. So I've had to turn down, I turned down Squeeze a few times, and I love those guys. They were about to do something, I think it was last year, and Chris had called me maybe 3 or 4 times over the years, and every time it was like, oh, I'm still not able to do it. So I really wanted to work with Squeeze. I turned down David Byrne the last show. Yeah, I had to, because that would, I couldn't, no way I could fit that in. I was supposed to play bass and be the musical director of that, of the America Utopia. That's a big one. I wish I could have done, I wish I had two of me. I would love to have done that, because I'm a huge David Byrne fan. Gosh, there's a few things. David Gilmour.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah, he was doing a very short tour, but even still, you can't commit to it. If it's, you know, a record is one thing, or a recording date or something short, or one-off concert, yeah, I could squeeze in some things, but it was very difficult to say no.
Do you feel doing more of the musical direction as well as playing the bass and the singing is something that you're going to do more of in future if you get more of an opportunity, or do you want to just kind of go into the shadows a bit more and just...
I don't know if I want to be a musical director. He offered me that position. I'd never done it, and I was, you know, again, if I had the time to kind of actually do that tour, I would have been brave enough to go, all right, I'll give it a shot. Well, you know, either I'm going to... I know plenty of musical directors, so I was going to get on the phone and go, give me some pointers. But I don't think I want to do that, really. I don't know if that's what I would... I would rather somebody else take that job, especially these days where a lot of things rely on computer stuff, which I'm not bad at it, but I don't want to focus on that all the time. I just want to play an instrument, and I find that I've spent more time on my computer now than I do learning how to play backwards on my bass. If I spent as much time doing that, I would be flying through those bills at this point. So I don't know if I want to do that, but I do want to have my own band again. So when we can get up and running, and maybe even before that, I want to get some musicians together and start playing some of my own music again, for sure. That's no question.
Well, if you come to London, I run the live nights at a place called the Groucho Club, which you may have been to back in the past. It's where Bury in Visconti used to hang out a lot, actually, in the years ago. And I run the live nights there, which are quite good fun. So. Yes, correct, yeah.
Okay, that's what I think I'm...
Yeah, on Dean Street, so... Oh, yeah. We'll have a chat about it, but I think it'd be perfect. It'd be perfect, depending on what it's like, but I think it'd be awesome. Of interest. We'll begin to wrap up in a moment, because I know that you didn't have too much sleep last night, so we'll let you have your day back in a moment. Do you think there's unfinished business with Queen, with you?
No, not at all. Not at all. That's Queen is my favourite band of all time, And I know that Roger and Brian, I was the first choice and when John Deacon decided he didn't want to play anymore. And I mean, and I said this to Brian May, and I meant it, and I mean it 100%, 100%, 110%. Just the fact that I was asked to do it is more than enough. And I have to say, I am nowhere near as good a bass player as John Deacon, and he is so underrated as a bass player, it's ridiculous. He's one of the greatest bass players of all time. If you can listen from Queen 1 all the way to... I mean, the stuff he did was just spectacular. But the four of them were spectacular. You know, there was something that they had and that, for me, has made them and will always be my favorite band, the most amazing live band I have ever seen in my life. So I didn't belong there. Like, that was like sacred to me. And I appreciate that they asked me, and that's enough. That was enough to know that I was the call. So I kind of take that and just hold on to it and like, wow, that's incredible. But that's not, Queen is, you know, it's different now. It's not really the Queen that I fell in love with as a kid. And they're still amazing, but I don't have any unfinished business at all with them. They're great. Roger and Brian are amazing. I went to see them when they played... the Hollywood Bowl, they played with when they had the other guy singing.
Adam Lambert.
No, before him, the one before.
Oh, Paul Rodgers.
Paul Rodgers, yeah, sorry. Yeah, yeah. I saw that show and then I went and hung out with had a glass of wine actually with Roger and Brian after the show. And I just adore them. They're just amazing people and they're my idols, what can I say? But I didn't belong in that band.
Think is an underrated skill that every musician should have. So I don't just mean by learning your technique on whatever instrument that you play, but what do you think is a really valuable skill or behavior that every musician should equip themselves with to thrive and become a success?
A degree of humility. not total, but at least some kind of... I think you really have to get along with people, and that does require a bit of kind of humility and just respect and a real dedication to the material. Forget about the person in the sense that the person you're working for, whose music you're playing, I should say, if it's not your own, if you're hired for a job. I think you have to just really step back and serve that. And that's what I mean in a sense by humility, not being like downplaying yourself, but just realizing that you are part of a team, even if it's just one other person or whatever. But you, and respect that position. I think that is something to learn. Like, there's no, for me in music, in really great music, and the music that really reaches people and lasts a long time, I think there's a degree of humility in that you can sense that the players are there to serve this piece of music, and this is why we love it and we feel it in that way. But when you hear, when you go into something and there's ego involved and someone wants to play more notes than someone else or wants to be louder than someone else or someone feels like, oh, I'm doing this, but I could do that better than them and I should, all of that, there's no room for that. And I think if you have this tendency, you should check it. Just check yourself a little bit. I think really serving the music is the goal, and leaving your other things at home or wherever you want to leave them. That would be my advice to young or upcoming or old or just people who want to play music. I don't, it doesn't matter your age or where you're coming from.
Great wise words there. Are you allowed to finally say what David Bowie bought you for your 50th birthday?
I'd rather not.
That's fine.
I will tell you, it's an antique. It's something that belonged to another very, very famous person. And it's an object. It's very old. And it's just, it's a beautiful thing, but it's not anything big or anything, but it was a well thought of gift that had a reason behind it. And, but yeah, I don't want to say.
No, that's fine. Thank you for your honesty on that. Mm-hmm. So the last thing is, I don't have any tattoos, but I'm going to get a tattoo of the Black Star logo. Awesome. And my partner and I are trying to decide where I should get it. And we came up with the idea of getting you to choose between the two places. So it's either going to be on my left bicep here, or just kind of underneath going across, or my left calf, like the back of my leg. Gail Ann Dorsey, where shall I get my tattoo?
Well, if you're really a David fan, you're going to get it on your calf, on the back of the leg, because that's where his only tattoo was, if I can remember.
Really? Yeah, oh, I didn't know that. Wow.
He had one on, I don't remember which leg it was, but the only tattoo he had was some kind of a, I'm trying to remember what it was now. It's like a shark or something like that, or something. I'm not sure if it was an animal, but it was something on the back of one of his calves. So there you go. That would be my advice.
Thank you so much. So, Gail, thank you so much for your humility, your wisdom. You've played on records that are going to be played for, you know, decades and decades to come. You know, it's been 100 years, you know, since your mum was born in Virginia in 1921. Oh, and, you know, you're going to leave this musical footprint over the next kind of 20, 30 years. That is just something she would be so proud of, I'm sure. You've changed the music world for the better. Thank you for being such an amazing guest on the Stage Left podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. And next time you're in London, come across.
I will definitely be there.
And before you go, Gail Ann, just tell us, how can people kind of support you or find out what you're going to be doing next?
Well, the best thing is to check me out on social media. I'm on Facebook. I have Gail Ann Dorsey Music on Facebook, and also on Instagram as Gail Ann Dorsey. I'm on Twitter as well, but I don't really tweet that much. I'm not quite sure what Twitter is. It's just this weird little thing with the bluebird. but also on top of that, if you check my social media, very, very soon I'm going to be launching a Patreon page so that I can be really connected with my followers and they can be connected with me. I want to learn some things from other people as well. And I have some cool things I'm going to want to offer. And also will give people a chance to be involved with my creative process, because I'm going to be working on some new material for a new album like we discussed earlier. So I'm happy to share that with people. So check me out on social media, and very, very soon we're going to be launching Patreon. Yeah, well, give my love to South London.
South. I will do. All right, go and get some sleep.
I will. Thank you. Take care of yourself.
So thanks so much for listening. For future episodes, you can check those out on whatever platform that you enjoy your podcasts on. You can also check us out at the Stage Left Podcast. If you want to buy us a coffee, you can do on there. And there's loads of other episodes with members of huge bands across the world who are sharing their wisdom for free. So we can each develop as musicians, but also we can support further generations who don't maybe have access to levels of education or universities, for instance. So people like David Bowie, Damon Albarn, Tom York, they all kind of did arts degrees, I believe, and not everyone can afford to do that these days. So, you know, this is why we do this podcast. So, yeah, hope you've enjoyed it. Do check out further episodes. Please like us on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram. So just search for at the Stage Left Pod or at the Stage Left Podcast. You can also support Gail Ann as well. So she mentioned her Patreon page. So you can check out that by searching for her on Instagram and Facebook as well. So that's Gail Ann Dorsey and that's Anne without an E. And we've got upcoming episodes with members of Gorillaz and DMAs as well. So we hope you enjoyed it and we'll see you next time.